Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics, government, and selfishness went wrong, and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of personal revival, aimed at making each of us more responsible, more cooperative, and more aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us, no matter what we find to squabble over. You can call us toll-free from the U.S. to 877-876-5227. You can call from Canada to 888-810-8322. Or you can call direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and we also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if one of those old-fashioned on-the-air stations in your area carries this show, you just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. And all past shows become available as soon as is humanly possible on the station archives. And I have a blog myself, and it's called How the Neocons Stole Freedom. And the story this week at the top is titled, The Digital War for Freedom, Has It Begun for You? Now, that blog was a natural extension of the article from last week about getting off the grids. And in that article, I've gotten into some more specifics. But when you read that, I want you to keep in mind that what we're going to be talking about there is what the powers that be have in store for us. The fact is that those same powers have really been making war on us, using our money and our institutions so that they can control what we do and what we have to give them. So if you have felt as if you were a POW, you had reason. Now, an example of what that means took place this last Wednesday when the FBI raided the offices of the Liberty Dollar, emptying their mint of 2 tons of Ron Paul dollars and walking away with computers, records, bars of gold, platinum, and silver, and closing them down completely. They were operating a commemorative coin business and maintained that they have been careful to operate completely within the law. There have been very few news reports on this, and all of the information that we've been able to get a hold of has actually come from online sources with people emailing each other. And one of those pieces of information I'm going to read to you, share with you right now, it's a letter from the man who started it and owned it to people who were his supporters. Dear Liberty Dollar supporters, I sincerely regret to inform you that about 8 this morning, a dozen FBI and civil service agents raided the Liberty Dollar office in Evansville. For approximately 6 hours, they took all the gold, all the silver, all the platinum, and almost 2 tons of Ron Paul dollars that were just delivered last Friday. They also took all the files, all the computers, and froze our bank accounts. We have no money. We have no products. We have no records to even know what was ordered and what you are owed. We have nothing but the will to push forward and overcome this massive assault on our liberty and our right to have real money as defined by the U.S. Constitution. We could not be defrauded by the fake government money. But to make matters worse, all the gold and silver that backs up the paper certificates and digital currency held in the vault at Sunshine Mint has also been confiscated. Even the dies from minting the gold and silver liberties have been taken. This in spite of the fact that Edmund C. Moy, the director of the Mint, acknowledged in a letter to a U.S. senator that the paper certificates did not violate Section 486 and were not illegal. But the FBI and services took all the paper currency, too. The possibility of such action was the reason the Liberty Dollar was designed so that the vast majority of the money was in specie form and in the people's hands. Of the $20 million Liberty dollars, only about $1 million is in paper or digital form. I regret that if you are due an order, it may be some time until it will be filled, if ever. It now depends on our actions. Everyone who has an unfulfilled order or has digital or paper currency should band together for a class action suit and demand redemption. We cannot allow the government to steal our money. Please don't let this happen. Many of you read the articles quoting the government and the Federal Reserve officials that the Liberty Dollar was legal. You did nothing wrong. You're legally entitled to your property. Let us use this terrible act to band together and further our goal to return America to a value-based currency. Please forward this important alert so everyone who possesses or uses the Liberty Dollar is aware of the situation. Thanks again for your support in this darkest time as the damn government and their dollar sinks to a new low. Bernard von Nothaus. Now, why did this happen? Of course, you know, maybe they decided that this was a way to make up some of those debts that they have. But the business has been in operation for some time. And just recently, Ron Paul, who, as you know, is featured on one of the coins, but is actually in no way associated with the company, has gained unprecedented popularity. So the possibility exists that this is actually an attack on Ron Paul. And there are several ways that you can view this. As Gandhi said, first they ignore you, then they ridicule you, then they fight you, and then you win. Could that be what's happening here? Other things with the Ron Paul campaign have been developing, and this came in from an activist in Colorado. Straw poll canceled due to overwhelming Ron Paul support. The Adams County, Colorado Republican straw poll was canceled last night due to an overwhelming response from Ron Paul supporters. The Adams County GOP expected only 200 people to show up. At least 600 people were in attendance. 65% were Ron Paul supporters. The Adams GOP then canceled the straw poll. For the leaders in the GOP of Adams County, Colorado, close to Denver, to do this is rather underhanded. This movement is snowballing. Please find out what you need to do to get involved in your precinct, county, and state level of the GOP. We must have candidates. And thank you to the gentleman who provided that to us on the web. In case you did not guess, the establishment is afraid of Ron Paul, and with reason. He changes the framing on all the issues. If you've listened to any of the debates, you can see the glassy-eyed and fearful look on the faces of the other Republican candidates. Now, many believe that it's actually Ron Paul and his phenomenal success that are at the core of this raid. Such well-known neocon flacks as Glenn Beck have done all possible to characterize the Paul campaign as a form of terrorist activity. You'll remember that the recent passage of House Bill 1955 began the process of clearing the way to characterize any attempt to change government as a gang or terror-related activity. Certainly ordinary people are now showing that when they become aware of the issues and what Ron Paul offers as an alternative, a return to real principles, they come out for him. And growing numbers every day are becoming active as volunteers. The growth of the Ron Paul campaign in Iowa and New Hampshire, as we discussed here before, has been marked by spontaneous support through individuals making their own signs, writing and downloading their own literature, changing their registration, doorbelling, and demonstrating for Paul. All forms of action that have historically been and remain the bedrock of political action, supposedly protected by the Bill of Rights. Few Ron Paul supporters are wealthy. Very, very few are on the boards of corporations. His supporters are ordinary Americans, alarmed at the direction we're now taking. You need to know. And now our thought for the week ahead. With the economy upside down and foreclosures spiking up into the stratosphere, Americans are worried, and they have reason to be worried, not just for that, but for other things that strike even closer to home than home. In Florida last week, children were traumatized by protocols that for 2 days in a row kept them locked down in schools away from their parents. The reason given? A crime had taken place that is normally handled by the police. In these cases, the two separate crimes, a robbery and an escaped convict, were used to justify a complete lockdown of the area around Fort Lauderdale. Government schools are unsafe, frightening, and they also fail to teach. students graduate without understanding elementary bookkeeping, the principles of electricity, much less physics, how our courts work, and many other subjects that two generations ago were assumed to be basic parts of becoming a functioning adult. In Maryland today, parents who entrusted their children to government schools are facing jail time for refusing to do what many experts now say is hazardous to their health, immunizations. The events are reported in NewsTarget, an online magazine that keeps Americans apprised of health alternatives. That article stated, quote, State Attorney General Glenn F. Ivey has announced he is willing to criminalize parents if they don't bring them to the courthouse to have them injected on the spot with vaccines that contain methylmercury, a highly toxic nerve chemical that causes brain damage and is linked to autism. The action is backed by Circuit Court William D. Missouri, Circuit Judge C. Philip Nicholas Jr., and the chairman of the Prince George School Board, R. Owen Johnson, Jr. Together, these judges and officials have conspired to turn Maryland into a medical police state, invoking the threat of imprisonment in order to achieve a vaccination goal that has more to do with politics than children's actual health or safety. Children have become targets of opportunity for the state, and every day more parents withdraw their children from government schools, determined to homeschool. But how to do that? If your children are at risk in the government school near your house, what can you do to protect them? One of the answers is provided by Dennis Klein, President, Carmel Games Incorporated. Mr. Klein founded Carmel Games in late 2003, a rather different venture than his preceding career in the telecommunications industry. However, he brought extensive experience in product development, engineering management, marketing, and business development to his new company. He quickly established his credentials in the field by designing, developing, and managing the production of his first game, Amagram Mania, in less than 4 months. Since then, he's developed further editions of the same game and two more games, Nimble and Equals. All his games have received numerous awards and excellent reviews. Here's a quote from the Carmel Games website that tells you a little something about his work. We have a passion for designing games that bring families together. Whether played at home, in social gatherings, or in classrooms, our games are engaging, intellectually stimulating, and fun. Our first game was launched in 2003. Reviewers loved it, and we followed that initial success with the 2005 introduction of the Junior Edition and Intermediate Edition. They, too, received enthusiastic receptions from families, teachers, and students, not to mention 10 prestigious awards. Mr. Klein holds a B.S. degree in physics from Imperial College, London University, England. Please welcome Dennis Klein. Hi, are you there, Dennis?
Yes, I am. Good evening, Melinda.
Well, I'm so glad that you could be with us today to talk about this. I know you don't normally think about what you do as being probably particularly political, but for a lot of families today, finding alternative curriculum and ways to educate their children and relate to them is something that's, one, a relief, and, two, something that they're coming to feel like they really need.
Yes, I agree.
And we always ask our guests to just begin by telling us something about themselves. So could you do that and share a little bit about you and your family?
Yes, certainly. Well, I live in Southern California. That's my good fortune.
Yes.
Where we are enjoying a nice bright day. I have a wife, and I have two children who are adult now, and they were both born here. You can tell, I suppose, that I wasn't.
Well, you do have a charming accent.
I've been here 32 years, so both of my children who are adult, but they were in fact born here. And they're out on their own doing very successfully. And we actually had the interesting decision to make, for different reasons than you cited, to consider how we would school our children. Ours went through private school, and they were very well off for that. One of the things that I regretted from my upbringing in England that wasn't carried over, hasn't been carried over in public education here, is the formality of education in languages.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I learned Latin. Fortunately, my son at the private school also learned Latin, but they dropped that in the year between the two of them. And it's a shame because those kind of things teach the fundamentals of education that are really something that you mentioned in your presentation that it was very standard two generations back to get a broader education in so many areas than the children get today.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that about language. I feel that about math. I think there's been an awful lot of experimentation at the expense of the children in education. We remember only a generation back with the new math, the new English. Well, to me, English is English, and you teach it by repetition, and people get their vocabularies, expand their vocabularies through usage of a rich set of words. There isn't any other way of doing it.
Well, no, there really isn't. When I was growing up teaching Latin, my sisters learned Latin just routinely in public school, and of course they stopped doing that quite a while ago.
And the value of Latin is that it teaches children that there is a structure to language. When you only learn one language, especially one that has its complexities like English, you don't necessarily acquire the idea that language is structured. And that once you learn one language, it makes it much easier to learn other languages. I personally lived in Italy before I came here, and I picked up Italian with considerable ease. I also lived in Canada, and my wife is Canadian and is French-speaking, so I improved my school English, my school French considerably by living up in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And those languages come a whole lot easier if you have that basis, that sound grounding in languages. And so I felt that it was time really to kind of get back. I know this is not exactly talking about my background, and I'll get back to that in a moment, but it is my hobby horse, if you like.
Well, I think it's fascinating, and I absolutely agree with you.
Yeah, I think we need to get back to the basics in all of the classes, and we need to make certain that we cover all of the basics. But my career didn't actually go down that path. I spent most of my years in my career in telecommunications and computers. I started for an American company back in England in the 60s working for IBM and moved around, as I mentioned, to Italy and to Canada and ended up here in 1976. And about, the mid-80s, when my children were young, we would be driving around in the car and as my wife calls it, my twisted mind would cause me to look at words that I saw in road signs or factories or wherever it might be along the way and say, can anyone think of an anagram of that particular word that means something? And I'd give them an explanation of what it meant. And as an example, about that time, Toyota had brought out the Camry, the first models of the Camry, and one time we were driving behind a Camry, and I said, you know, if I owned that car, it would be my car. And what's the anagram of that? And so they thought about it, and at that time it was new, so I said, well, you know, my car is an anagram of Camry.
Ah.
And at the time, we played this game, and my wife said to me, you know, that's a fun thing to do. Why don't you set that aside in your mind? One day, you never know, you might want to use it. Well, I did. I set it aside. I didn't use it. I was very much involved in my telecommunications company at the time. And that led ultimately to me finishing my career due to the downturn in the telecoms market, another of the issues that we face these days with international competition. But I ended up working at a company that got bought by Lucent in the late 90s, and Lucent Technologies, and unfortunately we all know what happened. Far too many Americans
know
exactly what happened. around 2002, and I ended up finding myself, and in fact all of our division found ourselves out of a job in 2002, and I was at the point where it was a decision, do I retire or do I do something more that will be fun? Obviously there were not very many senior positions available in the telecom world at that time,
yes.
The way things were going. I'd come from being a vice president of marketing in a division, and so clearly there were not going to be too many other opportunities at the level that I was at. In a downturning industry, and I decided that what I would do is dust off that old idea my wife had told me to store away and bring out my first game, which is where you picked up.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And, of course, playing with words like that, they found out a lot about, you know, cognition now, and playing around with words like that, it really does help children learn how to read.
Yes, absolutely. I think it starts with reading to the children. Then they learn to manipulate the language. They learn to manipulate the words. I just love anagrams, for example. And it certainly stimulates your brain. I haven't made a close study of exactly how the mechanisms that work, but I'm sure that my language is richer from simply playing with words. You know, I keep a dictionary nearby, and I consult it regularly.
Mm-hmm. Well, because it makes you take a look at the letters that actually make it up instead of learning to read as they try to teach people today. And that's they do the jumbles in the paper, and that's actually always been one of my favorite little games.
Yes.
I always go to the jumble first if I happen to pick up the paper, though mostly I get my news online now.
Yes.
Which I think most of us do.
We all do, yeah.
But, you know, all of these things go to, you know, one of the interesting issues, which is creating a facility for working with language. And I'm sure that that's why you were doing it.
Yes. I followed along that path with the first two games, Anagram Mania. I started out down the path of seeing it as a family game, and then I really realized that it was very educational, and of course I was thinking in terms of any platform, whether it be the public schools or private schools. Now, I consider those schools, I guess I'd almost say that you wouldn't run into one of the, you're less likely to run into one of the schools that you find, or school districts that you would find objectionable, if they're the kind of open-minded school districts that allows games to be used in classrooms and used in after-school programs. That may be a pretty extensive extrapolation, but I think that the schools that recognize that these are very valuable assets to use in training the basics, teaching the basics of language again, are probably pretty open-minded to the way we're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I followed it up by producing another word game, and you can see that's my particular love, and that game's called Nimble. It's based on synonyms, antonyms, and homonyms. We call it a game of equals and opposites. So I certainly went down the path of trying to work on games that were language-oriented.
Mm-hmm. Well, that does a lot to build vocabulary, which certainly enriches language.
Absolutely.
Which is wonderful for kids. And, of course, one of the things that you can do then is you can also use the rhymes in the words,
mm-hmm.
which, again, is a tremendous enrichment.
I thought about games like that. There are one or two out there, but I always try to find something a little bit different in what I've done. However, I did then move on to the thought that perhaps I shouldn't be so focused on language. At least I can come back to it when I have the next idea. And I sat down and thought to myself, you know, I wonder if I could explore other areas,
mm-hmm.
like math. So I did. And what I found, to my amazement, was that there really wasn't a very simple math game out there that exercised your brain, exercised your mental arithmetic skills. There were flashcards. There were some games, and there are now, since I bought Equals out, there have been some electronic games that have come out.
Mm-hmm.
But there really wasn't a very simple card game, as it turns out I used cards, that made children think about, I guess the same, it's almost a parallel, isn't it? It's like the structure of arithmetic, and that's called expressions. And so I came up with equals, and it does exactly what I said. It challenges the players to actually create expressions that match a target number between 0 and 99.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazingly simple, but a lot of fun to play, because when you have to suddenly look at a random set of numbers and operators and say, how can I put these together to create that target number, it really makes you think.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, that would be good for them cognitively in a lot of different ways, you can see.
Yeah.
And what they do is they start, instead of being you know, unfamiliar with numbers, they get so that they know which numbers go together to make larger numbers.
Absolutely.
So that's I can see that would be extremely important and very useful for you know, for kids to be able to have that. But I think one of the other things that you've mentioned that were one of the reasons that you wanted to do this was because it gave parents and kids a way to be together, to talk about something, and
right.
to relate to each other, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I watched my children growing up in the early era of electronic games, video games, and while there are some merits to some of those, certainly manual dexterity, moving those joysticks around, is valuable. The problem is that they've become, it's the content that has got so bad these days. Now, there are, that's not to say all of them, and I don't want to categorize it entirely this way. Their content, though, is often violent and destructive, and the parents really don't have an easy way to control that. Efforts are being made to put in some kind of rating system.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much attention that parents tend to pay to that. But more importantly, what those games have done is isolate the children from the parents. It's really taken away the interaction, the human interaction. So a major motivator for me in starting with board games and card games is to say, sit down, parents and children together, face each other, talk together, have fun together, and communicate.
Mm-hmm. So you get that facility there. You get, because having a conversation with, you know, people who are, you know, your contemporaries is very different than having it with adults. And many kids I know hardly ever really sit down and talk to their parents.
That's right.
On that level. So
absolutely,
that was one of your intentions here, right?
It's probably the greatest motivator. Because I think that the isolation of children from their parents is a cause of a lot of the woes in the world today. I mean, if you start out by not having that communication, so you become an island, you go off and you're susceptible to good and bad influences, but I should put the other way around, bad and good influences. Some good, but certainly a lot more open to bad influences that you might, that a loving, close family was not threatened by in the old days.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was real dialogue and there was a real sense of acceptance, and building that is very much facilitated by this kind of interaction.
Exactly.
So that was definitely one of the things that you wanted to accomplish, and the game does that too, because kids need that really face time with their parents. That's what we call it now, right? We call it the face time. When I was a kid, we called it something else. It was like sitting down and playing games with mom and dad.
Right.
But all of these things, of course, are extremely positive about the games. And a lot of parents, I think they feel a little bit intimidated. They need to have sort of a context in which to have that kind of interaction with their kids. And so you're really providing that for the parents, too.
Yes. We're going through the generations of change, aren't we? I grew up in a computer-oriented world, or was being in that area, so it didn't leave me far behind a little bit, I admit. My son is involved in computers, and I still use him as my consultant today.
How old is he?
He's 30.
Ah, okay.
So I've kept up pretty well, despite the fact that I grew up on big mainframes and card readers and so on. But I think a lot of our generation and even the one in between, you know, the kids of today and ourselves, have been left a little bit behind. And we find it frightening. We find it a little bit difficult, as you said, to communicate with the children for whom this is all natural. This is all their upbringing. This is their environment.
So, mm-hmm.
And I want to give the opportunity for the parents to find common ground and the children and the parents to sit down and do, as you said, sit and play together and talk together and smile together, laugh together.
Mm-hmm. But and they get a lot of other things with this, too, because one, that's actually going through and playing the game teaches them how to appropriately interact on that level. And at the same time, when you take a look at the content of this game, I just think it's very interesting because playing with words this way, especially with your parents, so you're being empowered to do it, it seems to me would give people a sense of playfulness about something that otherwise I think oftentimes children, you know, look at as simply being a tedious duty.
Exactly. I think what schools have a tendency to do is to create that exact environment. If it's presented formally, and I hate to say this, I used that word before, but I meant in the context of the content being formal and not too experimental and fringe. But if it's presented over formally in the sense of strict and drill, then some of the fun is lost and children will tend to react negatively oftentimes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that putting fun back into that formal structure is a great way of making them actually enjoy the subject rather than rejecting it or reacting negatively to it.
Mm-hmm. And as they go over the different, for instance, with your first game, as they go over the different words, you can see how there would be an opportunity to discuss where the words actually come from. Because so many of our words in English actually come from Latin, or they have, an ancient, and there are actually several different dialects or foundations for words in, for instance, England. Because you have Danish words, you have ancient Celtic words, and you certainly have the Angles and the Saxons and the Jutes who brought their own.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a good platform. Some people will certainly be fascinated to go off and explore that.
Yes, and I know that we did when I was a kid. That was one of the things. If you couldn't explain a word, you had to get up and get the dictionary. And explain
it. It's one of my favorite books.
It is absolutely, it's a wonderful book. And that's really one of the things you're doing here. I mean, you're really taking people back into the language that I think in many ways has sort of been abandoned because of the present way that most people learn it.
Yeah, I find it sad. But I look, and I think this applies sort of throughout the English-speaking countries, and probably in other languages too, but one of the negatives of the computer age, but not just because it was happening before, is that the spelling, the use of vocabulary is so diminished today over 20, 30, 40 years ago. The spelling is some of the stuff that used to cross my desk.
It's appalling. Language, people's spelling is appalling.
Yeah, good, you said it. I just had to turn a blind eye because you know, when you can't take a position as a manager that you have to redline every darn spelling mistake and every misuse of language. that would consume you, unfortunately. But it was tough.
Mm-hmm. Well, it would have to be, because it seems like they care. If as long as it simulates the word, it's all right. So one of the things that you're saying that your game does is it actually helps rebuild a true literacy.
Well, that's certainly one of its objectives. In fact, both games, both of the word games.
Mm-hmm.
Anagram Mania and Nimble.
And you can see different age groups could play it and get different things out of it, and you could use it in conjunction with the study of a lot of different other subjects, because as people, it's like, playing a game, and here's a word, you've made an anagram out of it, but other people at the table don't even know what it means.
Well, there's that, and actually you lead into a very good point there, which is that the future editions are going to be subject-oriented. One of the nice things about Anagram Mania is that clue packs will follow the first. Would mean you wouldn't have to buy a whole new game all over again. We do have two editions right now, and then future clue packs will come out. I'm in the process of writing the clues, and then after that we'll have some that are not general as the first packs are, but will be specific, so we can focus on different areas like geography or history or entertainment or sports, and have anagrams of all the words that are associated with that particular subject.
Well, so you could actually even then do a subset for poetry.
We could do, I think, as long as my brain keeps being twisted, suitably twisted, I can come up with a plethora of different topics.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can see that would absolutely be true, and it could be very exciting. And one of the ways that you're actually using the whole way that you're presenting the game to the public now is that so that people can actually start participating in the marketing of it, so that
That's
they
right.
can even profit by being part of that.
That's true. We started out 4 years ago in retail stores, and we've grown nicely. We've accomplished quite a lot. We've been in some larger stores as well as the smaller stores throughout the country. But I felt like there was something we were missing. What I found was that I have a number of very good retailers who have been enthusiastic about the games. We've been in educational stores. And again, how well the product is sold depends largely on how much the store owner would be involved.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're, you know, we're like any other product. If you're unknown, you don't have the mind share that the well-known products have. So we were competing for mind share before we could even get sales.
Mm-hmm.
And that's tough. Everybody who started out down an entrepreneurial path will understand that very well. And I also felt that we were kind of missing a lot of target audiences because we just don't have the bucks to be able to address them with the massive advertising that larger companies can. So when I sat down earlier this year and thought about how can I really accomplish what I would love to do, which is to get these games into the hands of the people who will really be able to understand and use them most wisely, I went back to something that I'd been introduced to probably 10 years ago, which was to go through the network marketing concept. And I thought, wow, you know, this is really interesting because network marketing is a marvelous vehicle for people to participate both from the games themselves and also from the opportunity to have a home-based business. And heaven knows there are enough people out there today, sad to say, who could benefit from a home-based business as long as they're willing to recognize that it is like any other business. It's a startup business, and you've got to diligently go about it. It's not a something for those who think they're going to make lots of money very quickly and very easily without working. Discourage people from getting involved for the wrong reasons. But if you treat it as a business, it's an excellent opportunity for people. And, you know, here's the other point about that. Home-based businesses are home-based. That means that if you're a parent whose children are at home before or after school, or perhaps you homeschool them, there's nothing better than a home-based business opportunity for people who have that situation. We don't want any more latchkey kids than we already have in this society.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's very much a child-based business. So that, you know, you can see that the child's probably benefiting from that in ways that you might not even have anticipated.
Well, that's right. Absolutely. I mean, I respect a lot of the multi-level marketing companies that are around there, but they're not focused on children in the same way that we're focused. So it becomes extremely valuable for the parent who has their children at home. They can use the games themselves. And I should say that while right now I have 5 games, I intend to certainly not to stop there, because I want to do as many good things as I can to try to help America. One of the things that I've done, by the way, is I've kept manufacturing onshore. It just took a little bit of work working with an excellent manufacturer here in California. I've been able to keep all of our manufacturing onshore. Unfortunately, I'll say, with the exception of a couple of parts that I couldn't even find made by any American company.
Oh, that's too bad.
Pardon?
That's too bad.
That is too bad. I had no choice but to get those in the Asia-Pac region, because I couldn't find anyone who did them, at least certainly not at the right price. And
well,
fact,
tell us what parts that those were.
No, I needed a special custom 30-sided die with letters on it.
Mm-hmm.
And if anybody is aware of any company out there that can produce them, so that I can still keep our games at a reasonable cost, I would certainly be open to hearing about it. But unfortunately, I couldn't find an American company that would be willing to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's too bad. And that's part of the problem we have economically.
So much has been outsourced. It's really frightening.
Well, I've made my best effort, and I'm glad to say that I've got a great manufacturer.
And they're actually even made local to Southern California,
yes,
right?
Yes, they're made over in Alhambra. He keeps his operations skinny, sometimes a bit challenging to work with, but we work together well, and he produces good product. And if we have issues to deal with, I'm right here. I'm a 50-mile drive from him. I can go over there. I don't have to catch a plane to China. And
that's a good thing.
Isn't it? Yeah. And so we can work out any issues very quickly and easily.
Now, oftentimes when people are doing game sorts of things, one of the things that can go along with that is people will do, like, tournaments.
Game
do people night? Do tournaments with the games?
I've not created any tournament for our game specifically. Whether other people have, I don't know. I've frankly been very involved with the development of the company. It's certainly been an idea that's crossed my mind.
Because you could see that would be a lot of fun to do.
It would be a great idea to do, yes. It's something that hopefully will evolve from our new direction with network marketing. By the way, the other thing I was going to mention is that over the course of the last 4 years, probably about 70 game inventors have submitted their ideas or requests to me to take a look at their games to bring out.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had to say no because of my focus on building our own company. But that's something I really plan to do now. I plan to be able to go back and reevaluate some of those games and say, hey, this fits the mold. We're looking for fun, family-oriented, educational games. And so those are the kind of products that I'll be looking to bring into the portfolio under a license arrangement with the inventor so that we can get their game out there, help them. It's another way in which we can help them help Americans get their product to market. And again, of course, I'll work with my manufacturer here in California to implement the games.
Mm-hmm. Well, that'll be a lot of fun, too. Have you noticed yet that you're finding kids who'd be interested in developing games? Because they try this game and they go, hey, what if we did this?
Let me think about that. I probably have. None come to mind immediately, but of course I don't always know the ages of the people who submit their game ideas.
That's true. You might not know. But
might not know.
I can very easily imagine that happening very quickly.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, yes. In fact, one of the interesting things is that one of the games that is not mine, in fact, it's the only game that's not made in the U.S., but I am handling it for the moment, and we are, in fact, looking at producing it over here with the blessing of the people who invented it in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
That's a game that has sold very well in Europe to companies, even though it's fun for children as well. We rank it as for age 11 and up. And guess what? The 11-year-olds oftentimes do much better than the adults because they haven't had the blinders put on.
Oh, really? What kind of game is it?
It's a creative thinking game.
Huh. Interesting.
Outside of the box.
That's the one, and of course that one's on your site, and it says outside the box.
Right.
Could you just sort of describe the game so we can see what it's like?
Well, let's see if I can think of a quick example that's an easy one. If you have, let's see, you know what, I'm probably going to state it wrongly, so I prefer not to try and give the example.
But
they
we
are,
won't make
they
you, if you if you don't feel comfortable doing it.
Well, there is one that talks about if you have a mixture of gloves, right-handed and left-handed gloves, in a bag, in a sack, how many do you have to pull out to be sure that you have, I think it's one of each kind. So you have to think about it, and it walks you through. That's a simple one, relatively speaking, but it basically is so cleverly designed. It starts out with the clue, and the card has a slider piece on it, so you can look, you can slide it up once you've read the problem,
mm-hmm.
and you can see what conventional thinking would be. And you usually, when you're not used to creative thinking, you'll say, oh, yeah, that's exactly the path I was following. And that conventional path will sometimes say it's impossible or you don't have enough information to solve this problem. And then you move the card up a little bit further and it gives you a hint. And then you turn the card over and you get the solution and then an analysis of how to change your way of thinking. So it not only shows you by example, it then guides you in understanding what that process was.
That would be fascinating for kids.
It's a deep game. It's absolutely a fascinating game.
Because you can see the sort of training that's sort of inherent there.
Right. And so that goes right along, and I picked it up because I thought this was a great game to add to the enrichment of the games that I have. You know, in trying to broaden to cover more fields, it seemed like that was an excellent addition. Very
mm-hmm.
cool.
And what kind of reaction do you get from the kids? Do they get excited? Do they get tired of the games, or do they just find more ways to play them?
The longest time period, the longest experience, if you like, with kids playing them is with some family members who came over here and took games back to England with them, and they continue to play them and they enjoy them.
Mm-hmm. So that's
children.
Not been a problem at all.
No.
The kids continue to enjoy them. Yes, I remember when I was a kid, we played games with my parents, and one of the things that when I look back on my childhood fondly, I remember the games, and you sort of remember all the things that went with the games at the same time. Because there really was a learning experience there, even if it was just a card game that you played routinely. That was fun.
They're a wonderful glue for relationships, for fun, for fun memories, as well as for the subject that they're teaching.
And you've experienced all those things with the games.
Oh, absolutely.
That they've
all the way up to adulthood. I mean, one of the nicknames that has occurred for Nimble occurred because adults were playing the game, and after we played a round or two of Nimble, which again is a synonym, antonym, and homonym-based game, one of the players said to me, after an amusing incident, an amusing pair of words was challenged, which is part of the gameplay. He said, you know, this really is a game of debatable interpretations. I said, do you mind if I borrow that expression? I'd like it. He said, not at all. Go ahead.
That's funny. So what you found is that when adults then play the game with the kids, they find more insights in it. And, of course, if the kids are playing with the parents, they're going to, you know, hear that too.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. So what you're saying is that these are games that enlarge the scope of how children think in ways that, you know, there aren't sort of just built into it, so it's limited. The only limitation is in the way that you use the game.
Yes, I'd say that's very true. We have both a closed-ended game that will be extended through the addition of more clue packs, Anagram Mania, and I say closed-ended because, you know, one of the problems is that I can't play with my friends having invented the clues.
Oh, well, that's true. That would be limiting for you.
That's somewhat limiting. I think I would tend to win the games. And they also think that I'm cheating. Nimble, on the other hand, is very open-ended, and I can enjoy playing it, and I love playing it.
Mm-hmm. And this is something, did you start playing this when you had kids yourself? Or was it when they were older?
The actual games themselves have only been out since, as I mentioned, I found myself out of a telecommunications job back in 2002, so my kids were already away from home at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But we did play that limited form, not in the formal sense, when we were in the car together. When they were little, I would just look at words and come up with a challenging clue. One of the examples of Anagram Mania, I mentioned the Camry as an anagram, but the way I've done it is I've couched the actual anagram source in a sentence, and when you find the anagram answer from the highlighted words in the sentence, it fits the clue. Let me give you an example. From the junior edition, she felt it just wasn't right is one of the clues. She felt it just wasn't right. Now, the word felt is actually highlighted. So when you shuffle the letters of felt to make the anagram left, you have the appropriate answer.
Oh, yeah.
Left is not right.
That makes perfect sense. Chris, now you've given us that one.
So I've given one away.
Yes. Could you tell people how to get in touch with you?
Yes. If they're looking at the games and or the business opportunity, they can go to greatnewgames.com.
And that's just greatnewgames.com. And then you have another site as well.
Well, the original site, Carmel Games, is the corporate site that has existed over the past 4 years. If they just want to buy the games, they can buy them there. If they want to right now buy the games there, one of the things that we'll have to do over time is phase out our sales through the retail market, through the typical retail stores, as we move over, because obviously we don't want to have channel conflict where people can say, well, I can go and buy this at the store, why would I buy it through multi-level? And that's just one of the things I have to deal with. But right now, we're right in our pre-launch phase, so
so it's still up there.
Yeah, and they're still out there. So Carmel Games is still active for purchasing.
Well, this is good. This is wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us today and sharing this. And I hope that everybody goes and tries it, because after all, Christmas is coming up too.
It's a perfect time for us to introduce them. And I thank you very much, Melinda, for the opportunity to talk about what we do.
Well, thank you so much. You take care and have a wonderful weekend.
And you too.
Good night.
Good night.
And that's our show for today, Friday, November 16th, 2007. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement, because we do this for our kids. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer, while evils are sufferable, than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom. And may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.